Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradhari. Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yasora Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Tiravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Astotra Sata Shri Srimadis Devanga A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Anantakoti Vaishnav Vrinda Ki Jai Kramtaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate hi Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayat Nasta Prayishva Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavat Yutama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Good morning, everybody. We're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 6, Text Number 31. Narayane Bhagavati. Narayane Bhagavati Tad Idam Vishvam Ahitam Tad Idam Vishvam Ahitam Grihita Mayoruguna Grihita Mayoruguna Sargadav Agunasvata Sargadav Agunasvata Narayane Bhagavati Tad Idam Vishvam Ahitam Vihita Mayoruguna Sargadav Agunasvata. Sargadav Agunasvata
Narayana Bhagavati
Parvati Tad idam vishvam ahitam Grihita mayarugunā Sargadav agunasvata Narayane bhagavati Tadhitam vishvam ahitam Grihita mayarugunā Sagadav agunasvata Narayane bhagavati Tad idam vishvam ahitam Grihita mayaruguna Sagadav agunasvata Narayane bhagavati Tad idam vishvam ahitam Grihita mayaruguna Sagadav agunasvata Narayane bhagavati Tad vishvam isvam ahitam Grihita mayaruguna Sargadav agunasvata Narayane bhagavati Tad idam vishvam ahitam Grihita mayaruguna Sargadav agunasvata Narayane unto Narayan Bhagavati the personality of Godhead Tat idam all these material manifestations Vishvam
all the universes
Ahitam situated Grihita, having accepted Maya, material energies. Uruguna, greatly powerful. Sarga Adau, in creation, maintenance, and destruction. Aguna, without affinity for the material modes. Svata, self-sufficiently. Translation. All the material manifestations of the universes are therefore situated in his powerful material energies, which he accepts self-sufficiently, although he is eternally without affinity for the material modes. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. The question put by Narada before Brahma concerning the sustenance of material creation is thus answered. Material actions and reactions, as the material scientist can superficially observe, are not basically ultimate truth in regard to creation, maintenance, and destruction. The material energy is a potency of the Lord, which is displayed in time, accepting the three qualities of goodness, passion, and ignorance in the forms of Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva. The material energy thus works under the supreme spell of his lordship, although he is always transcendental to all such material activities. A rich man constructs a big house by spending his energy in the shape of resources, and similarly he destroys a big house by his resources, but the maintenance is always under his personal care. The Lord is the richest of the rich because he is always fully complete in six opulences. Therefore, he is not required to do anything personally, but everything in the material world is carried out by his wishes and direction. Therefore, the entire material manifestation is situated in Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The impersonal conception of the Supreme Truth is due to lack of knowledge only, And this fact is clearly explained by Brahmaji, who is supposed to be the creator of the universal affairs. Brahmaji is the highest authority in Vedic wisdom, and his assertion in this connection is therefore supreme information. Om Agyanate Mirandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitamena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishnam Shtapitamena Gutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantitam Vanchakalpatu Vyasta Kripa Sindhubya Ipcha Titana Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo. Thanks for coming to the Bhagavatam class. This verse comes shortly. Maybe you kids in 10th grade recognize this, but this verse comes shortly after a section of the Bhagavatam we've actually been reading in our science class, our chemistry class, regarding the creation of the universe and where does all of the matter, where do all the chemicals that we see in the universe come from? And this is a great question, obviously, and nobody really knows the answer to this. We all have our beliefs, and we all have our evidence to confirm or support our beliefs, but I think it's fairly safe to say that nobody knows the answer to this. None of us were alive at the beginning of the universe, at least not in a form that we can remember. And so it's a good and a common question to ask, where did all of this come from? In fact, this is where human life begins. We were also talking in, I think, all of our science classes over the last week about the very beginning of the Vedanta Sutra, which says, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. And this is, of course, a very often cited verse or aphorism, which means that therefore it is time to inquire about the absolute truth. Atato Brahma Jigyasa. It is time to inquire about the absolute truth. And I always thought it was kind of interesting that this whole book, this great treatise on Vedic wisdom and philosophy and metaphysics starts with the word therefore. Atato in Sanskrit is therefore. Because normally, therefore, there has to be something preceding it, so you wouldn't find it at the beginning of something. But the Vedanta Sutra actually starts with this word therefore, atato. And what does it refer to? It refers to therefore, now that you have attained a human form of life, it is time to inquire about the absolute truth. And that's exactly what the Bhagavatam is an example of people inquiring. Many people, one person in particular, King Parikshit, but the Bhagavatam, as we shall see here in a moment, is a series of nested conversations. So it's somebody narrating a narration of a conversation that somebody else had on a different planet a long time ago, which is pretty far out, if you like literature and fantastic realities. The Bhagavatam is the book for you. And so we see here, this is a conversation that Sukadeva Goswami is narrating to King Parikshit about a conversation that Brahma had with Narada when Narada, a human being, asked him the same question. Where did all of this come from? And Brahma answered this question, and that's what the most of the substance of the second canto of the Bhagavatam is about. And of course, we know the first canto of the Bhagavatam is like an introduction to the whole scenario. The first canto of the Bhagavatam largely summarizes the end of the Mahabharata. It sets the stage for for King Parikshit leaving home, sitting by the banks of the holy river, and asking the great sage Sukadeva Goswami these really fundamental questions about life. Where do we come from? Where are we going? What is the purpose of my existence? Who is God? What is the essence of all knowledge? Really essential, important questions. Questions that are designed not to satisfy our immediate need to be happy, but to really answer the real problems that we face in life. What are the real problems we face in life? Birth, death, old age, and disease. This is the collected wisdom of all humanity across any religious culture you can think of will confirm that these are the real problems of existence. Birth, death, old age, and disease. So this book, this is not material knowledge. This is not knowledge about how to buy a nice car or take a vacation in Hawaii or obtain the latest video gaming console or whatever it is that we think are going to make us happy in the world. This is a book that has knowledge about how to escape or how to free ourselves of the real problems that we face in life. And King Parikshit was facing these problems at the end of his life. He ruled over this whole kingdom. And at the end of life, so he was the boss, right? Everybody's looking out for number one, right? We all want to be the boss. We all want to be in charge. We all want to be the smartest, the most beautiful, the most competent, the most detached even. We all aspire for these things. King Parikshit was, in fact, those things in the context of the world that he was living in. He was the king in charge of the whole world, basically. And at the end of life, he was faced with the same problems that everybody else was faced with. So what was really the use of it? One could ask. One could say that he enjoyed great material opulence, living in a palace with fine food and nice marble floors and beautiful artwork everywhere. But he was also responsible for managing that whole palace and the whole operation of it. And so any of you that have been involved with managing something know that that comes with a lot of headaches and heartaches and trials and tribulations. So there's enjoyment, but there's also a cost for the enjoyment. And at the end of his life, he found that he was in the same position as everybody else, from the most insignificant sweeper in the street to even Lord Brahma will eventually face the death of their material body. And King Parikshit was asking, what do I do about this? And we know the story. He renounced his kingdom. He went and sat by the banks of the river. Sugadeva Goswami came and narrated this Srimad Bhagavatam to him. And it began with, basically, he told King Parikshit, your duty at the end of life is to remember Vishnu. Right? That is what we're after here, is that at the end of your life, you should remember Vishnu. And so now we're talking about, who is this Vishnu that I'm supposed to remember? And Sukadeva Goswami begins to explain the universal form. And he's basically starting, and we talk about this also in our science classes. He tells King Parikshit who Vishnu is, and then he starts to unpack it. So the next verse of the Vedanta Sutra, which is also the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is Janmad Yasya Yataha. Vishnu, God, is that thing, that entity from which all other things are emanating from. That is the definition of God. It's that thing that was there in the beginning and will remain at the end. And again, this is not knowledge that is unique to Hare Krishna's living in Alachua County, Florida. This is universal knowledge that is spoken of in some form or another, or in some language or another, by all of the world's great religions. That God is the beginning and the end. And as we were talking about in the beginning, modern scientists, and Prabhupada gives a shout out to the material scientists here in the purport. We observe superficially many of the things that are existing in this universe. And by piecing together all of the different things we observe, we can come up with a theory about where this universe came from. And this theory works really well until you get to the point of the very beginning. And then the theory doesn't work well anymore. It kind of completely falls apart. And scientists over the last 100 years or so have spent billions upon billions upon billions of dollars and thousands upon thousands of human hours of labor and whatnot trying to solve this puzzle: is what happened at the very beginning of the universe. And this is the question that Narada was asking Brahma. What was there in the beginning? Narada suspected that there was something there before Brahma. He suspected that Brahma could not have been alone. And Brahma confirmed this. And that's what we read in our chemistry class in the 5th chapter of this. And so now Brahma is going into even more detail, and we're wrapping the story up by acknowledging that all material manifestations, this whole universe, is situated in Krishna's powerful material energies. That's all it is. It's just an expansion of Krishna's powerful material energies. And from our perspective, this universe is practically endless. We can see an end to it, but we don't know what exists beyond that end. We know that something has to exist beyond that end, but we don't know what it is. We really have no idea. But this is described in the Bhagavatam. Krishna is beyond the boundary of the universe. And there are an infinite number of universes that are emanating from Krishna all the time. So this is starting to unpack who Vishnu is. So Sukadeva Goswami first begins by describing the universal form. He says, well, you can see God out here in nature. You can see that these trees here, this is like the hair on God's body, these clouds, this so-called hurricane that's blowing through here, ruining our curriculum for another day, for no good reason, I'm sorry to say, is You know, these clouds, this is like the hair on Krishna's head. The mountains, this is like the bones of Krishna's body. So Sukadeva starts to narrate to King Parikshit the story of the universal form. And this is how you can begin to see Krishna everywhere you go. Krishna is present everywhere. We just need to know how to look for him. Krishna is present in the taste of water. He's present in the smell of the earth. He is the smell of the earth. Krishna is the purifying force of the wind. And so when the so-called hurricane blows through here, you can go stand outside in the mild breeze in a big field where the trees might fall, not to hit you, just to be safe. And you can feel the purifying force of Krishna, the wind purifying you, purifying your mind of anxiety, stress, all the stuff that we experience in our life that makes our experience less than wholesome. Krishna can purify you of all that just by standing in the wind. So Sukadeva is beginning to tell Parikshit, but then he unpacks it further. Parikshit is not quite satisfied. He wants to know more. And so then, through this narration of the discussion between Narada and Brahma, Sukadeva explains to King Parikshit how Krishna also is existing outside of the universe that we can observe. We can observe him in nature, but Krishna is actually beyond all nature. Not just the nature that we experience here on this earth, but the entire cosmic manifestation. Actually, this entire cosmic manifestation is just a tiny spark of Krishna's splendor. And there's an infinite number of sparks, and Krishna remains undiminished. This is the power of Krishna. This is the nature of the absolute truth. So material scientists can superficially observe this, but what they are able to see is not the absolute truth. We cannot perceive this using material senses. We need another method for uncovering this truth. And Brahma also narrated to Narada, what did he do? Well, what did Narada do? Does anybody know? Does anybody remember? How did Brahma uncover the truth that Krishna was lying behind this material world? You guys have an essay due on this on Thursday. They're nervous. Any of the adults in the room know what Brahma did? Oh, we got someone up here in the front. Don't be shy, my friend. Yes, let's hear it.
I think Krishna told Brahma and then Brahma told Narada.
Krishna did tell Brahma. Krishna appeared before Brahma. He said, here I am. But after Brahma did what? After Brahma practiced very severe austerities for a long, long time. 100 years of his own life. So billions upon billions of years, trillions of years, in fact. Brahma, trillions of our years. Yes, Narada.
And then Narada asked it to a
Brahmin. Well, let's not start mixing our stories here. Hold that thought. Yeah, so Brahma actually meditated for a long time, and he did this to purify our senses. So one thing we read here in this section of the Bhagavatam, we actually read in some detail how Krishna created the universe, or at least the order in which the material creation unfolded, beginning with the manifestation of space, followed by the manifestation of the... And with space came the subtle quality of sound. And with the subtle quality of sound came the gross sense and sense action of hearing in the ears. So with the manifestation of space came also the manifestation of the ability to perceive sound as well as the thing you are perceiving as sound. And this unfolds. Next appears touch and the ability to perceive touch, which is through our skin, and the things that we touch, which is air, something that has mass. And so on and so forth, all the way through fire and form, water and taste, and then smell and the property of earth. And so actually Brahma explains in quite some detail how this all unfolded. And he understood this because he was able to detach his consciousness from the workings of his senses. That was the practice of austerity. He was looking around in this great universe, which at that time was completely dark. He couldn't see anything. The lights had not been turned on yet. And he was wondering, what is going on here? Am I alone in this universe? Who am I? What is all this? And so he withdrew his senses from needing to engage with his external environments, and he brought them inside himself in the practice of meditation and austerity for a long time, a long, long time. So we see practically, and we'll give our young folks a reprieve from sitting here. Because we see practically people cannot even sit for very long. Thank you. Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to sip some water. So people can't even really sit, and I'm not talking about any specific people here today, but people can't even really sit still for more than single-digit amount of minutes, to be honest with you, is my observation. People can sit still for 3 minutes, 5 minutes. If you ask them to try to accomplish a task in those 3 to 5 minutes, the goal, the sambandha, and the abhideya and the prayojana of the task will be last. Really in less than a minute, the way that I observe it. And so what to speak of someone like Lord Brahma? Lord Brahma sat there and meditated for trillions of years. I think hundreds of trillions of years. I calculated this by our calculation. And so that is the amount of the endeavor that it took for Brahma to come to this realization. And there's even a verse in here where Brahma says that even I cannot understand the full extent of this whole creation. And so for me, that begs the question, what is the use? For thousands upon thousands of years, humans have been trying to answer this question, where did the universe come from? And this is at the forefront of science today. The person that just won the Nobel Prize for Physics a few weeks ago won a Nobel Prize for showing that quanta of energy across cosmic distances can interact with each other if the observer of these distances is observing in a particular way. And so... so even today, great discoveries are being made about the nature of the universe and how things work. But what is the point? Even Lord Brahma, after meditating for trillions of years with four heads and an overview of everything in the cosmos, he cannot understand this. So why do we bother with all this science and technology? Why, you know, what do we need cars for? What do we need to fly around the world for in pursuit of some goal? It seems kind of hopeless. But yet this is a human draw. This is a facet of human nature, that we are curious species. We want to know about our own existence. We have the quality of self-reflection. Anybody remember from our yoga test on Monday, the niyama of self-reflection? What was it? Svadhyaya. Yeah, this is a feature of human life. And it used to be, before... I'd say maybe 100 or 150 years ago, that people were interested in scientific pursuits because they wanted to understand God's creation. Isaac Newton wanted to understand how God's world worked. Copernicus, Galileo, all of these great scientists we hear about the distant in our middle-aged past, let's say, these were all actually deeply religious people that were investigating the universe using the scientific method in order to understand God's creation. Lately, this has changed. Now we use the scientific method in order to find better ways to improve our sense gratification. We use science to try to understand how can I better exploit and enjoy material energy. And we see that humans have done this over the last 100 or so years at great cost to our well-being as a species. Our ongoing and relentless demand to try to satisfy our senses using all varieties of artificial technological means is driving us to extinction, practically speaking. So we should be curious about the world that we live in, and we should use all of our senses and all of our properties, our facilities of inquiry, our knowledge-acquiring senses, our working senses. We should use all of these things to understand the world that we live in, not because we want to try to enjoy this world, or because we want to exploit this world, or because we think this world is somehow here for our enjoyments. Newsflash, it's not. This world is not made for your enjoyments. And by trying to enjoy the things in this world, we become more deeply entangled with it. We get more anxiety. We get more boredom. We get more restlessness. That's the cost of trying to engage in material energy. Rather, we should try to understand this world as a means to get out of it. Where's the exit? Where's the off-ramp? And by understanding this world as Krishna's creation, and all of the energies within this world as Krishna's energies that can be used in his service, that in and of itself is the off-ramp. So that is the answer right there, is to understand who the proprietor of all of the energy in this world is, and what is the purpose of that energy. And what the purpose of that energy is not how can I use this energy to make me happy, But how can I use this energy to make Krishna happy? And that is a topic for another class. So I'm going to stop there before I rant on and people get too restless. And before we wait, yes. Have at it, yeah.
Thank you so much. Very wonderful class. Made some notes and very, very complete and very well said.
Thank you.
Just a question about. Okay, so we all know that Krishna is the supreme controller, but wait a minute. We can do stuff without his permission, right? So does Krishna also control that?
Krishna is the supreme controller. That does not. That's a multifaceted question. That does not mean that he is controlling everything. That means he has the ability to control things. But because the world is unlimited, he also has to give living entities some capacity for free will. So he doesn't really interfere with the free will of the living entities. That's one answer. Another answer is that Krishna has his will. He has things that he wants. And then he has things that he will allow to happen. So he is also in control of what he will allow to happen, but what he will allow to happen might not be what he wants to happen. So, you know, Krishna does not want to see war, right? This hurts Krishna's heart to see living entities in the material world suffering the really gruesome hellscape of war. Krishna does not want to see environmental degradation. He does not want to see ancient trees torn down for palm oil plantations. But he allows this to happen because we have free will. And we don't see the consequences of our free will. We see the effects of decisions we've made in the past based on the bodies and the experiences that we have right now. But we don't know what the consequences of our actions will be in the future. And so therefore we should be very careful about engaging with material energy. So Krishna has what he wants. Krishna wants sweet rice, right? He wants people to come here and cook large pots of sweet rice and then pass it out to everybody. That's what he wants to happen. But he will allow people to go to the Popeye's Chicken on 441. He'll let it happen. So he's also in control. Another level of that question, and sorry to go on and on about this, is that I think I'm moving my hands. Like, I think I'm controlling, like, I'm speaking, I'm using my senses, I'm breathing, but I'm actually not doing that. The only thing that I'm really doing is desiring it to happen. So I want to speak. I have a desire to speak. This is communicated through two demigods that are here watching us, that see all of this. And there's a communication channel between my desires and the faculties of air in my body that allow me to move my hands and all of the different tissues in my body and the waters of my body. And this all happens so quickly that I think I'm doing it.
Yes.
But I'm not. Yeah. If I were to think I'm going to say something now, and now I'm going to say it because it took that long for the message to get to the demigods to control my mouth, I would realize, wait a minute, something's going on here. Something is more than meets the eye in my consciousness. But it is all organized so beautifully that we think we're the controllers, that I think I'm actually in charge. And based on our previous activities, we have different abilities to enact our free will. So one of these ancient old growth trees that I just mentioned, these are my favorite things in the world, to be honest with you. Like, I would love nothing more to go to an old growth rainforest and just hang out there and chant Hare Krishna, really for the rest of forever. But what is really the experience of this tree? We know on a subtle level they communicate. Through their root systems, there's electrochemistry running throughout the soil that allows them to communicate, but they can't really dance in kirtan, right? They can't move anywhere. If it's snowing, they're just standing out there in the cold. If it's sunshining, they're just standing out there in the sunshine. If the fire comes, they can't get away. So although they are ancient, powerful beings in some way, as far as their integration with the overall ecology of the earth as an individual living entity, they're quite limited in their free will. And that is an effect of their past activities. We as humans, we have a great capacity to exercise our free will. And even things that we don't have free will to do, like fly, Like everybody wants to be able to fly. We've figured out a way to do it anyway.
What about criminal activity? Like, so, you know, I was a kid. I wrapped a house one time. You know what wrapping a house is?
Yeah.
Right? You take...
I thought you said you robbed the house one time. Like, oh, it's true confessions.
You know, I do have Catholic background. So, yes, Father, I have sinned. Please forgive me. But, yes, I took, me and my friends, we took 70 rolls of toilet paper, and we completely may-tagged the whole trees, all the trees, the fences, the yard.
Nice. Okay.
It was a mean neighbor. You know, it was a mean neighbor that was kind of harsh and difficult with children whenever we would ride by.
Yeah.
You know, he'd say, stay away from my house. And so finally we said, oh, stay away from your house. Okay. So we decided to do that. Fortunately, the Houston police happened to be on patrol. And not only that, they let us finish.
Oh.
They let us complete.
They didn't let the neighbor in.
They didn't even stop us. They watched us do the whole thing.
Yeah.
That we did all of it. And, you know, we were all scrambling when they turned on their lights and beat the siren. And, you know, what was I, about 10 years old, you know. And so they beat the siren. And, hey, guys, and they rounded us up. Me, a couple girls, and another couple guys. And they rounded us up and they said, guess what's happening right now? You're cleaning this up.
You're cleaning this up.
And it was already 1 a.m.
Yeah.
We cleaned until the sunrise. And they sat there.
Yeah, it took 5 times longer to clean it up than it did to mess it up to begin with.
We cleaned up every single inch of it. So I was fortunate. I got the reaction right away. But a lot of people think, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
It's Krishna's house. It's Krishna's book. It's Krishna's temple. I can just
unfortunately,
walk in here and do anything.
It's Krishna's temple, so nobody's responsible for it. No, it's Krishna's temple, so we must be very responsible. I'm responsible for it, and we are all collectively responsible for it. But that starts with the individual. So I am responsible for Krishna's temple within my capacity to do things the right way. And it's limited. There are power structures, and that all needs to be there. As far as criminality is concerned, we should give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, as Jesus said, regarding following the laws of the society that we live in. And thankfully, we still live in a society of laws. And so we should follow those laws. As far as the laws of nature are concerned, you cannot break the laws of nature without a consequence. You will get a reaction. The only way to not get a reaction is to be freed from the whole thing. So you don't know when you're getting a reaction, or you don't know what the nature of that reaction will be, but rest assured, it's coming. Yeah, and you might experience, and I think all of us have experienced this, at least the adults in the room have experienced this in one time or another, and the kids, for sure, are constantly complaining about how unfair something is. And so we all have experiences where, you know, we feel like we're being treated unfairly, but are we really? You know, maybe in that immediate circumstance, the way we're being treated doesn't, you know, is not merited by how it arose, but there are certainly other times in my past where I've acted contrary to the laws of God and man. And so it's just an extremely complicated web. This is how karma is described. And there are details of it, you know, but in every seed of material action is the desire for another one. And so it's a dangerous entanglement. And the more you struggle to get out of it, the more entangled you become. If you see a mosquito, maybe this is in the mode of ignorance, but I like the spiders that hang over my eaves. I think they're beautiful. I think their webs are beautiful. They're eating things that would bite me. So maybe in their mode of ignorance, I happen to like them. And so I watch them. And something like a moth will come and hit the spider web and it will try to get out. And if it just stays on the web and doesn't move, it has a chance when the time is right, when the breeze hits it in the right way, if the temperature's right, all of the material things, it can kind of jump away. But as soon as it starts to move and try to disentangle itself, it's finished. It gets wrapped up in it. And so that is our involvement in material life. Yeah. And so it's recommended in the Bhagavatam not to try to disentangle yourself from it, but to cut yourself free, to cut the entanglement with a weapon of knowledge. And that's what this is, Shastra, is the weapon of knowledge by which we actually cut ourselves free from material nature. And you don't even need to understand it. And frankly, as you get older, you will learn how to pay attention better. But just hearing the sound vibration of somebody narrating the Bhagavatam is purifying. The sound vibration of it alone, even if you don't, as Prabhupada said, there is no need to understand the language of the mantra. The sound vibration is purifying. If you are able to understand it, that is even better. But just hearing it will cut the attachment. And therefore, to wrap things up, we say in the beginning of the Bhagavatam class, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, Nasta Prayesh Vabhadreshu, cutting, destroying all of the abhadra, all of the inauspicious things in your life. And you guys are complaining about inauspicious things all the time. Oh, the homework, I need to sleep, you know, all of it, all of it. Social anxiety, anxiety about your bodies, your mind is an anxiety, you're bored. These are all inauspicious things. This is not you. This is material nature. And by engaging in devotional service, by hearing from the Bhagavatam, and by endeavoring to render service to the personifications of the Bhagavatam, all of these wonderful people, these wonderful adults you see around, you will in fact experience lasting and ever-increasing bliss. It's just a fact. Haribol. Any other questions? We got 5 minutes, 4 minutes. Any other questions, comments? Yeah.
So you reminded us that the real problems of life are birth, old age, disease, and death.
Yeah.
So that can be summed up that this material body is the problem. However, it is the only thing we have to engage in devotional service. So, is it... Actually, that's the solution to the problem.
That is the solution. Yeah, I think you answered your own question. Yeah, we use our body. The body, this body does not belong to me. Also, we were talking in our biology class yesterday, so we were comparing what do modern scientists say about life, what is life, versus what did Srila Prabhupada say about life. And in many cases, they're very similar. Everybody recognizes that we go through stages. There's cycles, birth, growth, reproduction, maintenance, dwindling, death, and then it all starts over again. And the biologists recognize the same thing, basically. They have a little more detail, a little more nuance. But the one thing that Prabhupada explains differently is that Prabhupada explained that consciousness, our ability to perceive and interact with the world around us, is not a product of the material nature. It's something else. And so our consciousness is permeating this body, and when our consciousness leaves this body, it will enter another body. And when we cease to need material bodies to enjoy through material senses, we will also have a spiritual form, which is imbued with all senses. And so this is also a point here in the purport, that the impersonal conception of the Supreme Truth is due to a lack of knowledge only. We are eternally persons. And our ability to serve Krishna right now is limited by our material body. We are not able to serve Krishna as fully as we would like to. I mean, I would love to be able to teach these kids 24 hours a day and then go cook Rajboga like it's a festival every single day of my life. I can't do that. I'm physically limited. But still, we should endeavor to use the body as far as we can in Krishna service. Yes, Prabhu? We got another one in the back. And then...
Thank you for the nice class. The scientist says that for the things we know, that we can explain accurately, if that's not portrayed accurately in a religious text, then we cannot use that religious text as an educational text. And they always quote the Bible. Bible says that human life began 5,000 years ago. And the age of the earth is 5. You know, we cannot accept that. And therefore, we cannot accept the Bible as an educational text. But I'm thinking also that they would come to us with the Bhagavatam on these same issues, really. How would you try to clarify this kind of...
This is a topic for like a whole master's degree, I would say. In the 2 minutes left, I will comment that yes, there are things in the Bhagavatam that we cannot perceive. Or the Bhagavatam explains the universe differently than what we perceive with telescopes. And that's just a fact. And I think what do I say without getting angry emails from the people online? That's just a reality, and it's the same in the Bible. The difference between, for example, the Bible doesn't say the earth is 5,000 years old. The Bible is used to, that is one piece of evidence that's used to calculate that. So it's a line of evidence. But the Bible actually doesn't say that. So it's anuman. It's not shabda that the earth is 5,000 years old from the Bible. The problem with that is that it's very easily, you can easily prove that the earth is not 5,000 years old. That's a claim. The claim that the earth is 5,000 years old is a testable hypothesis. I can go find a rock here in Florida that is way older than 5,000 years. And there are rocks that are way older than 5,000 years all over the world. So it's a testable claim that has been repeatedly disproven. The claim that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead who's running through an imperceptible spiritual world, playing with countless millions of cows and blowing on a flute in the moonlight and chanting hundreds of millions of Lakshmis or gopis, this is actually a testable claim, which is why Krishna consciousness is a scientific process. But to test this claim requires, as Lord Brahma did, trillions of years of severe austerity. Then, if you can, that is the experiment that Lord Brahma engaged in. He engaged in the yoga system for trillions of years. So that is the experiment. So who can do this? Nobody can do this, right? What you can do is chant Hare Krishna. That is the simple method. And then these things become revealed to you as they are needed. Otherwise, these are topics for discussion amongst devotees. How is it that the Bhagavatam can explain that the whole universe is only 4 billion miles across? This is barely the distance to Saturn, which is just this one tiny solar system in this one tiny galaxy in this one tiny universe. So, yeah, these things don't quite add up, but you don't really know what the Bhagavatam is saying. The Bhagavatam is not quantitative information in this regard. It's describing a mandala, a bhumandala. So mandala is an object of meditation. So the purpose is not to understand it. The purpose is to discuss it joyfully from all angles of vision in the association of devotees. That's what I will say without getting any angry emails. All right, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai.